Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Wrestling with the Angel of Democracy is a book about the inner life of democracy, which is a tremendously exciting idea. I read and reread this book because it contains about 2010 ideas, or 2010 plus ideas. All 18 of Susan Griffin's published books move beyond the boundaries of form and perception. Her groundbreaking book, Woman and Nature, is an extended prose poem and inspired the eco-feminist movement. A Chorus of Stones, The Private Life of War, blends history and memoir, as does this book tonight, Wrestling with the Angel of Democracy, which explores the state of mind that engenders and sustains democracy. Susan Griffin was named by the Utney Reader as one of the 100 important visionaries for the new millennium. She's been the recipient of many grants, including an NEA, a MacArthur Grant for Peace and International Cooperation, an Emmy Award, and a Guggenheim Foundation Fellowship. A Chorus of Stones was a finalist for both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. And in addition to her prize-winning works of prose, Susan is also an accomplished poet, which you'll see when you read this book, and a playwright. She's also co-authored the script for the Academy Award-nominated film Berkeley in the 60s. So without further ado, please welcome Susan Griffin. Welcome back.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here again.
In your central library, which you
My
do.
My library.
In your library.
Yeah, which I came to as a high school kid.
And it really was a refuge for you, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. And it was a revelation, too. I mean, because I had never seen, you know, those sort of big murals, the WPA stuff and everything. I'd never seen
it. And you were coming from as far away as Canoga Park.
Reseda. Yeah.
And so downtown...
A little closer.
So downtown L.A. really was a... Like another world, or
well, I mean, I had lived with my grandparents who lived very close to L.A. And when I was my parents had lived also in a duplex with them in that same house.
We're going to talk about that childhood, which you weave into so much of this book. But I thought just to give you a background in what this book is like, I thought it could tell us a little about what is a social autobiography. I don't know if that's a term that you use or it's been used about. And how would you define what that is?
Well, I think it's comes from probably my thinking about my life, not only my life though, but the self as we frame it. And in this culture, as you probably well know, the mass marketing is so much towards somebody having an individual fate, even though in fact the encouragement is to dress and be like everybody else. But it's this great emphasis on individual fate, and it's interesting now. I think that with this economic downturn, people are again really questioning, you know, that sort of logic. But I've always experienced my life as very contextual and been aware of being fortunate in many ways. Actually, I mean, whereas had I been born in the midst of World War II, it would have been a different story. But I was actually born near the end of World War II.
And one of the central questions, you actually pose it at the end, but I think it informs the whole book when you say, who would I have been had I not been born at the time I was?
Exactly. That's and so I've used my life in these series of books, not because I think my life is any more interesting than anyone else's, but just because I'm intimate with my life. I know what I felt. I can speak very authentically about what I felt and what I was going through internally and psychologically. And I'm always putting history together with psychology, the soul together with politics, you know, that sort of blend. And so I use my life for that purpose.
I think in Chorus of Stones you wrote, we're not used to associating our private lives with public events, yet the history of families cannot be separated from the history of nations, which is something that you do so beautifully in this book. So let's take a look at this kind of foreground about of your life, which you use to look at democracy, especially your sense of place, because you're rooted in Los Angeles, yeah. You're rooted in the West, you're rooted in California, and you talk about your childhood being shaped by an egalitarian sensibility. What would that mean in a post-war Los Angeles family?
You know, and it's such a great question, too, because, you know, my grandparents were Republicans, and my mother was just... I would say virulently apolitical, you know, I mean, just like absolutely, you know, steadfast lack of interest in politics, except that she did say that she wouldn't vote for Nixon because she would never buy a used car from him, you know, so that was the way that she thought politically. But my father was a working guy, and he was a union guy, but he would go sort of back and forth between...
He was a fireman, right?
He was a fireman. So he'd go back and forth, and he took odd jobs, so he worked as a janitor sometimes, he did all kinds of things. You know, he'd go back and forth between Republican and Democrat. So my parents were not progressive, and I point that out in the book.
Right.
But in fact, I was born in 1943. In 1946, which is when the war ended, a book that we're all well familiar with came out, and that was Benjamin Spock's, you know...
He's kind of the first character in your book.
How to raise children, and I used that when I raised my daughter, but I think that the publication was very significant, but not only because the book was so influential, but because the book was articulating a movement that was already afoot, as most books do, as my books, everybody's books, are articulating something that's a spirit that's already happening among people. And so there was a shift in this old way of child rearing, which I call the psychology of monarchy.
Mm.
And so from my parents, I experienced the sort of the general Spockian philosophy, which was, you know, respectful towards children, much more respectful. They weren't, you know, it wasn't Summerhill. I mean, we had bedtimes and tasks, and we're taught table manners and to say please and thank you and all of that, you know. But when I would ask a question, you know, why are you telling me I have to do this, or why can't I do that? They wouldn't say, because I said so. They'd give me some sort of explanation. So what I say in the book is that what was happening from a very young age is that I was being taught to reason, even if I myself was being unreasonable, which I was, as most 5, 6, and 7-year-olds are quite often. I still was given the chance to think about things, and eventually I did learn.
So you're looking at these things, these qualities that came through in your own childhood, and at the same time you have a parallel narrative, which is really like, what is it that we need to sustain a democracy?
Yes.
And also, how did the forefathers come to these conclusions?
Right.
So there's the, you know, the sense that you have a sense of self-esteem and you're given a sense of self-esteem. Well,
yeah.
How did that work in terms of, and then you're leaping to Thomas Jefferson and we're off into the, you know, the founding of the nation. It's an amazing balancing act that Susan's doing in this book, and it really works because she's flowing from this personal narrative into historical narratives and back, and you almost can't tell when you're going from one to the other. It's really very seamless. It's very beautiful.
Thank you. It takes a lot of work. It's sort of, I think of it like carpentry in a way, mm-hmm. you know, where you just have, you know, certain carpenters and make certain joints if they do them with wood rather than screws, and they just, you know, it just takes a lot of detail work to get that to work, and I learned detail work very young. I was a copy editor at Ramparts, actually, and being a poet makes you, you know, good at that too. So I'm very glad you felt that.
And you're remembering these things, so it might start with you remembering a photo of Jefferson with a certain
yes.
glow about it.
Yes, that glow.
That takes you into uh-huh. imagining his life. And also I should mention there's an extraordinary bibliography in this book because you draw from a lot of sources. So there's Jefferson, and he's struggling over, his texts, and at the same time, he has a great contradiction in his life. He's writing the Declaration of Independence, and he's a slaveholder.
Yes. Well, as many of the founders were, Washington was also a slaveholder. Many of them were. Those who were from the South, mainly, they were from relatively privileged classes. If they were in if they were representatives in the Continental Congress at all, most of them came from legislative bodies within the colonies, and a lot of them were Virginians, and they held slaves, or they held people in bondage. And yet, many of them were against slavery, and that's one of the, you know, that's why the title is Wrestling with the Angel of Democracy. It's not the angel, because what I'm saying in the book is that democracy is constantly changing. It's constantly a process of evolution, and that these ideals that we have were not immediately realized, and they're still being realized, and we're having to expand not only the Constitution and our body of laws, but we really are having to expand our minds, and our minds in every sense of the word, intellectually, but also more profoundly, I think, psychologically. Mm. We have to keep expanding.
Mm. You have quite a cast of characters in the book, in addition to your parents, your sister, your grandparents, and childhood friends. Yeah. So we move through Thomas Jefferson, John Muir, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Rose Schneiderman, some of these names you may know, Angelina Grimke, Melba Petila Beals, and I thought I would stop on the idea of one of the characters, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and perhaps you could read a section, because you're talking about, it's page 70 to 71, you're talking about how transcendentalism sowed the seeds for future movements like ecology and conservation and environmentalism. But you're focusing on the freeing, I love this, the freeing of Emerson's mind from deceptive lessons. So what we learn in childhood, we also may have to unlearn. So part of your book is about the learning, and part of it is about the unlearning.
About the unlearning. And they go hand in hand.
Yes, they do.
And as a preface to this, I want to say that because I use Jefferson, by the way, and the writing of the Declaration of Independence through the whole book.
Right.
And so that, to me, there was a direct progression from Jefferson to Emerson. And I think they were alive during a little bit of the same period. Emerson, in the Declaration of Independence, many people don't know that when he says, you know, when in the course of human events, one nation has the right to rend itself asunder from another, that, you know, we have to explain to the world why we're doing this, and we do it, we have the right to do it, because from the authority of nature and nature's God. Mm. He doesn't say from the, you know, to hear the right wing talk now, you'd say, well, one nation under God, and this in the Pledge of Allegiance. Well, that phrase in the Pledge of Allegiance is rather late in American history, and the earliest reference to any authority beyond human authority in American the American documents that make up our legacy is nature and nature's God.
And this is a moment when set us up for it. So Emerson, he's
at a period. I studied closely this little period in his life, because what I was trying to find out in all of the figures was, you know, how did they have the courage that they did to make these leaps, which they made for all of us, and how were they able to do that? And this was a point at which Emerson had increasingly become disillusioned with certain traditional rituals in the church, which he had to, be in charge of. What do they say? There's some church word for that, but I don't know. But he had to conduct them.
Right.
And he felt like a hypocrite. And one of them, which he really, really disliked, and it's interesting to me because I don't dislike it. Not that I'm a Christian anymore, but is the Eucharist. He really disliked that. I guess he was in this generation. He was still in the generation of people. He was very attracted to the Romantics, but he still really also belonged to the generation who worshipped reason. And to him, it was so unreasonable. You know, you're not really, you know, drinking the blood of Christ or eating the body of Christ. You know, he just found it irrational. So he didn't. But I think on another level, that was a key to him to freeing himself from a doctrine that would have prevented him from seeing divinity in nature. So when I found this event, which I'm going to read, this is my description, but I found it in his journals, and this was right in this period when he was deciding whether to, I think he may have already sent this letter to the church board, but he had to decide if they said, you have to administer the Eucharist, then he had to decide whether he'd hang around and still be the minister or whether he'd quit. And so he did decide, actually, to quit and moved to Concord, and that's where he wrote his essays that are the most famous to us, the bulk of them. And that's where Transcendentalism was developed in this amazing community of people, including Thoreau and Louisa May Alcott. So anyway, the passage in his journal that caught my eye is when he went to hear another preacher speak on Sunday. So the preacher here is not him. He's congregation.
In the pew, right?
He's sitting in the pew. As he sits trying to listen to the sermon, he finds it intolerably dull. He bears the minister no ill will. He is a good man, well-intentioned, Emerson believes. Nevertheless, he lets his attention wander. He is drawn toward the window. Not just his eyes, but his whole soul leans in that direction. While the preacher's monotone words drone on, he gazes at a patch of the countryside covered in snow. There is a snowstorm outside, and the snow keeps on falling. But all this whiteness, the repetitive, silent motion, which he has doubtless observed since infancy, does not bore him at all. Was there a wind, the passage of clouds? Were there shafts of light striking here and there with sharp points of illumination? That evening, he would write in his journal, the snowstorm was real, the preacher merely spectral. Vast contrast to look at him and then out of the window. He is near the end of a longer conversion, one that began in 1831 and would continue for 7 years through doubts and decisions followed by waves of insight until finally he decided to cease his weekly sermons in Lexington before delivering the famous address to the graduating class at the Divinity School at Harvard, the lecture that expressed his harshest criticism of the theological tradition in which he had been schooled. It was because of this address that he would not be invited to speak again at Harvard for 13 years.
It's a beautiful chapter, which you call Yosemite, because you spent so much time up in the Sierras.
Yes.
And you talk about how this regard for nature, I mean, you talk about John Muir and how this whole kind of your whole, then you go back into your own childhood and your own discovery of nature. Could you talk a little bit about that?
It was a rough period for me in my childhood because my family, my mother had a very severe problem with alcoholism. My parents divorced for that and because she'd been having an affair. So they divorced, and I was, the whole family sort of dispersed all at once. It was very traumatic for me. I was just six. And the worst part of it was that, you know, I was sent to my grandmother. My sister was sent to my great aunt, who lived in Davis, California. So you know, that's outside Sacramento. So we were, we had been very, very close before that, and it was as if I lost everybody in my intimate family all in one day. So it was, I became very, very shy in that period, and sort of, it was painful. So, but my sister and I would reunite at summer camp in the Sierras, and we went to this camp near Lake Rucker, which is just below Donner Pass. Other little campers and I adored the fact that people ate each other up far away from where we were. Anyway, my sister was older than me, and of course she was, you know, they had the different ages in different little campsites, and so I wasn't allowed to be with her for much of the day. But I established wonderful friendships there, and I also established this very powerful relationship with the place itself, the trees, the lake, the mountains, and that was one of the most profound spiritual experiences, and remains so. I mean, I still have that relationship.
So in the process of recalling this, and you're thinking about the things that you did at camp and remembering, you know, that some of these things that the scout leaders would teach you were from Native American lore, which
yes.
is how many of us first became aware of Native American lore. And then you look at the history of scouting, and there were two models. One was the militaristic model, and the other one
right.
was really to draw from Native American culture.
Seton, this guy, yeah. Seton,
yes.
who the story behind him is he was, where was he? I think he was maybe Canadian, was he? But he was, anyway, he in the town where he lived, there was a theft, and these kind of juvenile delinquent kids in that period, you know, turn of the century, and so he instead of, you know, advocating sending them off to jail, which some people wanted to do, he said, well, send them over to me. And he started teaching them Native American lore and taught them, you know, how to make a teepee and how to wood carve and all kinds of things that I lash, you know. Do you remember lashing from camping and all that stuff that I was learning? And these kids really it turned them around. It really saved them.
So then it's not really until we're, you know, many of us were adults that we really find out what happened to the Native Americans.
Yeah.
And you have this beautiful whole section on the Trail of Tears and on the Cherokee removal.
Yeah, that was an incredible experience writing that. I mean, I got, you know, it's funny because I'm friends with Alice Walker, and we're really good friends, and we were arrested together protesting the Iraq War, and that's in the last chapter. I don't write about Alice, but I write about being arrested there. Anyway, Alice was very supportive of this book, but she said, I hope you put the Cherokees in. Alice has some Cherokee background, and I said, well, I said, I don't know, because I told her I was writing about Emerson. I said, well, and I knew that Muir actually was not somebody that I wanted to write about his relationship with Indians. I could have, but I really didn't want to, because he was sort of old school, and he looked at Native Americans as savages, you know, sort of, and I just didn't want to go into that. But Emerson had met this Cherokee man and had been very, very moved, as Jefferson had when he was younger, met Native American people, been very, very moved, inspired by them. And so then I tell that man's story because of it was in that same period in Emerson's life when he was going through this pivotal change, and he heard this Cherokee man speak, and by the way, he was speaking in Cherokee, so he was being translated, but what Emerson was moved by was the tone in his voice. So he had quite a tragic story, and I won't go into it now, but I did do a lot of research in the Trail of Tears, and I might be wrong, but I looked in practically every source I could find, and there was nowhere any one single description of it. Various authors would describe parts of it, but there wasn't a sort of long, comprehensive description.
It's a really beautiful, sad narrative.
I made a comprehensive description from these pieces. I put them together, but as I was doing the research, I couldn't get a picture of the whole. You know how it is when you're just doing this, again, detail work. In this case, it was research detail work, but I was, you know, I couldn't see the forest for the trees. And then all of a sudden, one night, and I rarely work at night because I get too tired, but all of a sudden it just started to rush through me. And it all came out, all of a piece, and I was weeping. I mean, because I really got, I got what that event had been, and we don't understand it enough in American history. It ought to be.
Yeah, just that little detail. I mean, just as you're saying that, I remember you pulled out the women walking through, being kind of having to walk through the creek, and their shoes being, you know, ruined, and they were about to walk
thousands of miles
in those same shoes.
That's right.
Just that little detail.
Just that detail. Yeah, and of course there was lots of they were put in stockades that were about as close as you can get without the gas ovens to the concentration camps, and they were, and the women were raped, and they were put on a starvation diet, and.
But you sense them. That was actually an analogy I was thinking of when I was reading about the Trail of Tears, because you talked about as a child, kind of, you know, your first intimations of these other people who had lived here, growing up in California, and they're being, you know, you're having loved. Your parents bought you this Navajo or a belt or something. Something about it you really loved. And I was thinking, you know, I've been traveling a lot in Poland working on my book, and how a number of young Poles have said to me that they always felt there was something missing. They didn't know what it was, but they felt like there was something, like there was a hole pulled out of the carpet.
Oh.
You know, and then they would discover later, like one young man was studying linguistics, and he went off to find the people who spoke Yiddish, and then found out that they, you know, he had never heard anything because it wasn't taught under communism.
Yes.
So there was a similar kind of hole torn out of our fabric.
Absolutely.
In the country and in California, which had such a rich Native American culture.
You know, I went on the site for Aloud while I was packing, and I had just seen this film by Julius Shulman, and I think it was he who talks about Pico Boulevard. And my grandparents, I was partly raised by them and lived on Highland, on Kensington, not far from Pico, and Pico used to be an Indian trail.
Right, and he said, and his scout troop actually would walk it, it was like out to the ocean, it was dirt.
Right, it was like in the 20s or something.
Right.
I mean, it's so amazing.
Yeah, I did feel such a bond in reading about your post-war childhood in Los Angeles, and your one of the most brilliant chapters in the book I really love is the chapter called Jazz. It really sings. And
glad you like that. I love that.
It's really great. And you talk about Frederick Dumont and the role and this incredible role he plays. And I thought maybe you could just tell us a little bit about this character who becomes Jelly Roll Morton.
Yeah, Frederick. Yeah, he was you know, he himself was in a way a quintessential American, although. You know, in America's racist, aspect, he would have been viewed as an outsider. But in fact, he's quintessential because he was a blend. You know, it was Creole, and he had, you know, African American roots and French and Spanish and all of that in his background, and that indeed is jazz comes from African music and, you know, European music blended with Spanish rhythms, and he was one of the originators of jazz, along with, you know, all the other greats we know, Louis Armstrong.
And you're moving from this discussion of jazz again to your own life, to documents about history. And I wanted you to read this passage. It's 222 to 223, and you've just found out very tragically about your father's death. And you talked about there was an alignment with the most basic law of existence, that everything passes, what you had learned after your father died, and then you move on from there into jazz.
Some of the grief over my father's death, I did grieve his death when he died, but not, I think, fully. And when Kennedy was shot, I think a lot of people experience that sort of thing. When a public figure is shot, then you go through other levels of your own grief over somebody who's died. And so I'm talking about Kennedy's assassination. Now I was stunned, dislocated, and temporarily speechless. The heady sense of power I had briefly experienced replaced by a ruthlessly unbending confrontation with reality. But simultaneously, if at first almost imperceptibly, something else began to grow in me. It was less with pride than with a lonely awareness that I realized I knew about life and death in a way that my friends did not. This was a sad certitude, yet it contained another kind of power, giving me, instead of control over circumstances, an alignment with a most basic law of existence: everything passes. It is perhaps this knowledge you can hear in jazz. It is there in the breaks, in what Jelly Roll called the idea in the breaks, the ideas in the breaks. Listen into the pause. The knowledge is in the absence. a long open space without sound. That's death for sure. The end of a certain road, and in the quiet, a disquiet, as you realize you don't know where you are going. And then, something new starts up, perhaps teasing and small at first, and even limping in its rhythm as if it will never catch. But hang on, it will, or maybe you will hear a loud, undeniable flood of sound, and you have no choice but to go along with it all the time, singing, not the same, not the same, never going to be the same again. When read in the way that Jefferson intended, the Declaration of Independence begins with a series of pauses that seal within them a sense of loss, and yet at the same time, through the force of rhythm, transfigure mourning into a brave departure. In the rough drafts of the Declaration that survive, it has been argued that Jefferson made diacritical marks to indicate where pauses in speech ought to be made. In the first printed version of the Declaration, a series of odd quotation marks and later odd spaces were included, which the scholar J. Fligelman interprets as the printer John Dunlap's confused response to Jefferson's original marks. Using this evidence, he has constructed the preamble according to the way Jefferson wished it to be heard. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. In this pacing, you can hear a dignified sorrow at the loss of an old order, and after each break, a powerful voice rising up to claim the future.
I think that's really thrilling. I mean, you just took us from the death of your father back into jazz, back into Jefferson, and back into, you know, a whole different kind of hearing of the Declaration. And you've also set this up because we've been talking about, you know, this courage that it takes to face a new order, to take something in. And here, I think this is the first time you said a dignified sorrow at the loss of an old order. And I never thought of it that way. I mean, of what you're giving up, you know, in the course of a revolution. That was kind of startling, too.
It took me a while to get that. And of course, you know, when I first read, you know, and became aware that Jefferson, along with all the founders, were really, you know, believed in monarchy and obeyed the, were loyal to the crown and all of that. And so this was this evolution that they went through to separate from that. But then that meant, as Emerson himself had to give up, you know, this ministry, and it was a very esteemed position he had and a long tradition he was part of, which must have made him feel safe and located. And, you know, it's a loss.
So that courage that you talk about in so many of these characters, Rosa Schneiderman with a triangle fire and the unions, is that right?
Yes.
Especially Melba in Little Rock.
Oh, yeah.
So you talk. Yeah. So she's one of the. Tell us about.
She was one of the Little Rock Nine, and most of us, you know, I felt very linked to that story because I remember, you know, having arguments, my sister and I, around the sort of Sunday dinner table or the holiday dinner table with whoever, you know, whichever time it was, with my father and sometimes my mother and stepfather and my grandparents. And my sister and I would be the ones arguing for civil rights and for integration, and all the others were against us. And, you know, and the Little Rock Nine were part of it because that was sort of the dramatic event of that period that a lot of turning around happened during that, you know. And it was TV images. And then I met her.
Oh, you did?
I don't think I put it in the,
no,
put it in the book that I met
that.
Her, but there's a sort of group that has these luncheons, a guy who has these luncheons, and if you want to go and meet this person and be in a fairly small group and hear them talk, you can. And so I did, and I met her. And then I read her book, and I was just stunned.
Yeah,
it's a great book. I really recommend it.
And what you put in, I mean, what she went through, I mean, from, you know, people
tromping on her feet as she, I mean, throwing things at her.
She had acid thrown in her eyes. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was very, very fortunate and lucky that she wasn't blinded. I mean, there was one of these, it was this famous brigade that Eisenhower sent down, and they were very well decorated from, you know, the Second World War, and they were very honored. And this guy was sort of her private guard, and the kids literally had to have a guard follow him around because the other children were so violent towards him. And those children were trained by their parents; they were set up and pushed into doing it, and trained. And some of them did it with great relish.
And some of them, after, I mean, years later. It was the girl who saw herself in the photograph.
Yeah, I don't ever name it, but it's in the book. she was became the iconic figure of racism, and has remained so throughout.
Because of that famous photograph.
Because of that photograph, and this was not Melba, but it was another. Kid who got separated from the group, and it was terrifying because she could have been killed by this mob, and there was a mob following her, and this at this point it was the Arkansas Guard, and they weren't doing anything to defend her, and she was just, you know, trying to walk away to get to some sort of safety, and you see this picture of this woman just screaming behind her, just, you know, in a rage, screaming. Well, that woman.
She was a girl at the time.
She was a girl, right. Actually. She looks like she's older, but she really was just a high school girl. And years later, she contacted Melba and apologized. And then she went one further and said she wanted to apologize publicly. And eventually they ended up becoming friends and going around the country and talking about racism and the importance of people, you know, becoming.
And that's when you say, in such circumstances, and thinking about this girl and those who responded in that way, and maybe the few who didn't, in such circumstances, why do some respond sympathetically and others with increased brutality?
Yeah, I was right.
A question that bears on democracy.
Yeah.
But this whole question of, could you talk a little bit, maybe before we open it up, like, why is empathy so important to democracy?
It's key to the whole book. And in a way, it's a story. The whole story of the book is in a way a story of how empathy is the bedrock of democracy, and how it works is this: that all men, really should be human beings, are created equal. That statement is not just a sort of ontological statement, but it's a legal statement too. And the shift in law depends, that gives us freedoms and rights, depends on equality. There were always rights back to the Magna Carta, and even before, there were aristocrats had rights. Certain people were given rights by the crown, and they had those rights. But the idea that everyone, not just certain aristocrats, but everyone, every citizen would have rights equally, not some people more than others, but equally. That was what the radical idea, that was the radical idea that the nation was founded on. And that, once you have that legal system, then, you know, we've all been through this. I mean, I remember from grade school, you know, I may not agree with what you're saying, but I will fight to defend your right to say it. Well, if you're going to fight to defend what somebody's saying, you're also going to think, well, you must want the same rights I do, and then you begin to think about what somebody else may want, even if they're very different from you. You begin to, and that movement of your imagination. And that movement of imagination is very large and very, very much part of American. Of the American spirit and the American soul, if you will. I mean, that's what Whitman's all about. You know, when he said, I sing of the working person on the dock and the bonded person, you know, carrying a heavy load, and the washerwoman down by the water. You know, I'm all of these people. You know, so there's that movement of empathy that you begin to think, you know, what must you feel? And then I go on to say that I mean, when I wrote about Melba Patil Beals, what I wrote about was that I, being part of the civil rights movement, I did out of empathy.
Right.
But that led me to understand myself better. It led me to expand my understanding of who myself was, because I learned a whole vocabulary of disenfranchisement. I learned psychologically what being marginalized does to the soul. I learned about internalization, the self-hatred that is engendered by prejudice. And then I suddenly, along with a whole generation of women my age, realized that was happening to me as a woman. So the women's movement, the second wave, and as did the first wave, by the way, because a lot of the women who were the first suffragists and they had been abolitionists, and Angela Grimke, who was a famous abolitionist, wrote directly in her letters, you know, that was my school. My school of learning about my own human rights was in fighting for abolition, and my school was the civil rights movement. So there's a way that when you empathize with others, and Whitman caught that perfectly in his poetry, yourself, who you are, expands, and I think that's one of the great beauties of American democracy.
Absolutely, and you capture that so well in the book, and how we through all of these characters, you know, how we can, and places. I mean, one of the reasons I love Aloud, or I love this space and people in it, is that we kind of have to practice learning to disagree with each other, and you know, and there aren't that many places I feel like where you can do that these days. I mean, in person, you know, so. We want to invite you into the conversation to agree or disagree. But I wondered if you want to read this last, just because it's such an amazing section. When you're talking about locating your story within a larger history, this section about your mother that also goes to it's 153, I believe. And then we'll open it up to you all. It's a pretty dramatic scene. I just felt like it was important to hear this.
So, you know, I did say that my mother was alcoholic. I didn't live with her through my whole childhood, but in different periods of my childhood. And what my mother's, you know, people are very different when they drink. And my mother's sort of alcoholic personality, she was very different when she was sober, really very different. But when she would drink, she would move into a stage where she was very nasty. She would start by laughing, making witty comments about our family, my stepfather, the television, one of our cats. But soon this laughter would dissolve into tearful self-pity. How misunderstood she was, or what a mess of things she had made. If in the beginning I would be moved by her lament and I felt sorry for her, over time, whenever she would enter this phase, I learned to brace myself for the appearance of the mean side that I knew would be coming soon. She was always perceptive, but in this stage, her perception would turn into a weapon aimed sometimes at her husband, her friends, and then without exception at my grandmother, and finally at me. Whenever it was she who told me or my sister, by then I knew that my grandmother, the matriarch of the family, had urged her to have a second child to save her marriage. I knew her resentment had settled on my conception and birth, muddled somehow with her guilt over her abandonment of me, and I sensed that the admiration my grandmother had given me from the first day I was born, one that she withheld from my mother, angered her too. I had already begun to stand up to these vituperative barrages, refusing to sit still for her drunken ramblings, when one afternoon, after she had already had several beers and said something objectionable, words I cannot remember now, I responded sarcastically. It was then that she came across the room and slapped me hard across the face. I was not used to this behavior. I can remember only 5 times that anyone in the family ever raised a hand to me, and this partly accounts for what followed. I stood up immediately from the chair where I had been sitting and hit her back. Within a few moments, we were on the ground wrestling with each other. I cannot recall who ended the physical conflict, but as soon as I was standing again, I told her I was going to call my father to tell him I wanted to move out of her house, and that is exactly what I did. Though I knew immediately that my response was fully justified, it took me years to integrate what happened on that day. First, to be able to tell anyone outside the family what had occurred, and then, almost in the same breath, to grasp the depth of the pain I felt from the fury and hatred my mother had directed at me. The pain of such a perception is often enough to prevent those who are abused from admitting the full truth of what they have suffered, even to themselves. It is an odd connection, but it occurs to me now why a passage that has usually bored me must have felt so important in the Declaration of Independence, the long list of all the wrongs committed against the colonists by the King of England. Saying the words would have broken a trance, arresting the tendency to believe in a benevolent monarch, which would be to believe in safety itself, that the world as it has has a predictable and reliable order, and that thus whatever has been suffered is an anomaly and will, like all illusions, disappear by itself over time. So repeating the list, declaring it in public meetings at courthouses and meeting houses throughout the colonies, and reading it to the new American troops would have engendered the courage that was necessary to wage a revolution. To name injustice almost always inspires courage. Even without a long and solid tradition of democratic theory, unfairness assaults the soul, engendering an almost physical response. The difficulty is not in confronting anyone, convincing anyone that injustice is wrong, but in proving that a particular injustice has really taken place. Not only those who have witnessed injustice, but even those who have suffered it, are often unable to acknowledge that it has happened. Over many years, I came to admire my younger self for the courage I showed when I resisted my mother's assault. Yet at this moment, I am more interested in what developed before this courage, how I came to know that the way my mother treated me was wrong.
Thank you. It's really amazing. Susan, when you decide, you know, in writing a memoir, because this is a memoir of a kind, you have to have a filter, because there's so much that happened to you and there's so many incidents, and yet the ones that you end up using, that you pick, that lead to these conclusions are so precise. So is there a lot on the cutting room floor? Is it like knowing? I mean, you have to know which ones fit into this theme of democracy, and who would have known that this fight with your mother would have ended up in the Declaration of Independence.
Did you
know when you were writing it?
I knew, you know, when I got to that place. But I think at those sort of moments, it helps to be a poet, because poets work a lot by association. So you sort of trust what comes up. I don't immediately go with it. Of course, I weigh it and play with it. And there's also the question, you know, I teach writing, and I always like to tell my students that the book has a body. You like, you know, as if you were dancing with somebody. You have to dance with it. You can't make it do just what you want it to do. You have to, you know, move with it and sense what it wants. And the further you get into a book, the more the book is leading you.
You do have wonderful metaphors. That reminds me, once in a writing workshop I took with you many years ago when I was struggling with my book, and you said, and I said, I can't work on it every day and I'm so upset because I have this full time. You said, you know, think of it as a good friend. And, you know, some friends you talk to every day for like an hour, you know, or once a week for an hour, and some friends you just check in with a little bit, and that's okay. Just check in with it. It was so helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for this book.
It's wonderful.
And I want to invite you into the conversation. So if you have a question for Susan, we have a microphone here, and we will call on you and bring you in. There's someone right there.
Good.
Yeah.
Hi. I just want to start with a gratitude. I read Woman in Nature years ago, and it was such an important book for me to learn who I am as a woman in the world.
Oh,
so I want to thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I'm glad.
Question?
Don't all talk at once now.
or I'll jump in again.
Yeah.
Right there. Hi. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
This is actually quite timely and a little challenging for me. Because I actually walk around with a lot of things that I want to write down. And The question is about courage. You mentioned, you were talking just a minute. I'm a little bit spaced out because events from Thanksgiving are still reeling in my my heart, actually. Yeah. And it was one of those turning points kind of thing. And so I think I struggle with the courage to actually write down what you were talking about as injustices, because there's a part of my mind that says, well, everyone suffers, everyone has, you know, wants to, everyone has lots of suffering.
Yeah.
And so what, why, you know, if I write it down, it's just another person's story of suffering, and we all have that. So I rationalize it away. That it's my voice,
yeah,
it's not that important.
You do rationalize it away, yeah. Well,
and so the courage to actually write it down.
Yeah.
And also there's another voice that's, it's a punishing voice that says, well, you know, you can't do that. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Which is a very paternal voice as well.
Oh yeah, we all have those voices, by the way. And it doesn't matter how many books you've written, they come up. So you always have to do battle with those voices. Not that they go away, but I would think more like Aikido, you know, rather than, or wrestling is a kind of Aikido, because that's what happened with Jacob and the angel, you know, they blessed each other in the end, you know, so it's an intimacy. So with that voice, I wouldn't go directly up against it. I would just say, oh, gee, who are you? You know, who are you? You're interesting, you know. Oh, gee, you know, it's part of your background, so it's part of the terrain that your mind is struggling in, so kind of it's just, you know, speaking, the voice is speaking, so, you know, oh, now I can see, you know, what's there. But as far as just being another voice, you know, it's like, you wouldn't say that if you were, like, in a, if you were in a chorus, you wouldn't say, oh, well, I'm not going to sing. I'm going to let everybody around me sing, but I'm not going to sing because they're all singing. Why should I sing? See what I mean? It's, I'm trying to point out that everybody's voice is really very important. And you have no idea some of the time what it is that you have to say that's different, because to you it's very familiar. But everybody's voice is unique. And all of our kinds of suffering are unique. And there's something, you know, the process of writing that is healing is not catharsis. It's transmutation. That's what's healing. So when you write it, you work it into a thing of beauty. In other words, make it into a song. And then it finds its power, so you achieve a certain mastery over what's hurt you that way, but also beauty. And in that process, which is a kind of alchemical process of the soul, you begin a healing process that's very deep and very ancient, because these formal qualities, formal aesthetic qualities, contain teachings that go back, you know, to the earliest, they go back to oral poetry, the oral tradition of poetry before the written word. There's understandings, trance states, for instance, used for healing, you know, in human culture for centuries. And when you write a passage that has music, you put yourself into a trance state that is different than a negative trance state from advertisers or something, or, you know, fascist trance state, but more, you know, it's a profound, you get connected to the whole universe and you get the healing of all existence. So begin where I would begin is, don't try to tell the whole story in the beginning, it's too hard. Just begin with one detail or one phrase and let it open out. Don't try to be rational. And above all, don't try to argue or convince, because that's defensive, and then you're back in that powerless position. So that's my sort of hope that helps.
Susan?
Thank you, and we have been reading your book and love it. We're not
thank
done,
you.
But My question to you is this: our ongoing struggle, I think, or one of our ongoing struggles in this democratic nation is the individual versus the collective.
Yes.
And I think we're in a period of very fierce tension around that
right now.
Boy. And I wonder what you might have to say about that in terms of how you might have thought about that in writing the book and how you think of it now.
I just think that this divide we have between sort of capitalism and socialism is so empty right now. It's an empty husk, you know. It was built up during the Cold War, and really, it turns out both sides were quite wrong. You know, I mean, I come from the progressive side, and I write about this in this book. You know, I the guy who brought me to the first time to the Central Public Library, Henry Steinberg, who's a member of the Communist Party, he was such a decent, good guy, but. You know, and I found out from his older daughter that, in fact, he did know about the Stalinist stuff, or he did find out about it, and he himself was disillusioned, but he didn't talk about it a lot. You know, but I didn't know that when I wrote this book. We reconnected through the book, but so you had this idea, you know, and capitalism is no longer capitalism at all. Capitalism is closer to the Stalinist Soviet Union. Than it is to anything, you know, that was sort of free enterprise asserting itself against monarchies and aristocrats at some point. Now, you know, the corporate control is the biggest danger we have, and all the people who fulminate over the danger of the power of the central government don't realize that the government is the only protection we the people have against the corporate power. And the real power in this country right now is corporate power. And you see this, and now they're talking in Congress, thank God, finally, about perhaps doing a little trust busting against the insurance companies who get together and rig the prices. So we don't have competition. We don't have capitalism. We've got this rigged corporate power. And most of the insurance companies, by the way, are tied to other major megalith corporations. So I think it's a time. I do hope we get a healthcare package in, and even if it's not the public option that we wanted, even if there's a little bit of a public option, that we can stand on that ground and build from it. Medicare certainly has been built on. It's not true that whatever is in is never can be changed. But the point is to get to be able to stand on this ground that there's nothing scary about a public option. I mean, I have Medicare right now and I love it, and I also think that we need to start a new discussion that happens on a deeper level. So I'm so glad you brought this up, and that is that no man or woman is an island. We are interdependent. That's what it means to be alive on the planet. Every breath you take has gone through various trees and green grasses, and everything we eat has had 1,000 lives before it, and we would not exist at all were it not for everything around us. So we aren't in the long run individual, and yet too much centralized power is a danger economically and politically. So how do we work that through in a way that's intelligent and delicate and not not duplicitous and rapacious, really?
Susan, as a kind of offshoot of that, so much of what you talk about in the book, I think this relates to your question, is being rooted in place. I mean, and your sense of democracy and came a lot out of landscape and the West, and your affection and noticing this landscape. I don't know if you read in the current Harper's, there's a really terrific essay by Richard Rodriguez on the death of American newspapers.
Oh, I really have been wanting to read it, and I haven't
done it yet. It's quite good, and he talks about how growing up in Sacramento, how the newspaper was the newspaper of record, so it's where we recorded births and deaths, and it defined a community. Now, San Francisco may be the first big city to go without a newspaper, and as a friend told Richard, you know, people under 30 won't notice. So as we have less and less, in a sense, we have localized. I mean, here's Jim talking. You know, we have through our food, we have more of a sense of locality, perhaps. But we're also becoming more. We're in this kind of cyber place where we're connected. You know, we can connect with friends in India as easily as I can connect with you in Berkeley. So what does that do to us as citizens of democracy? Well, I know that's a really large question. But
it is. There's two. It's a very large question. I don't think I can answer it largely. I'm going to focus in on a couple of things. One is with the demise of newspapers. I'm you know, I am of old school, and I love newspapers, and I'm really, really sorry to see them go. And maybe there's some way that they can revive and find a new form. But one of the things that is being lost with both newspapers and magazines is investigative reporting. And investigative reporting is just extraordinarily important. And the cyberspace people don't do that. They don't pay a lot. They don't have a stringer. They don't send people out to develop contacts. And those skills are being lost. And to me, democracy, speaking of democracy, is really dependent on good investigative reporters. So that itself is very serious.
Figure out a new way.
Yeah.
Right there.
And oh, there was one other answer that I wanted to give, which is I feel that there's something. One of the good things about, I guess, the internet is that in cyberspace you can run a very, very long article, so it doesn't, you know.
Right.
It can go on and on because they're not, you know,
people
they're
can
not
find
worried
it.
About, you know, column inches and all of that. I love what you're saying, Rodriguez said, because that created a sort of there's a common platform in which discussions could take place, you know, and public. One of our problems right now is there's not enough public dialogue on a serious level. It's all these sort of soundbite things. And even, I mean, you know, I just adore Rachel Maddow. I have withdrawal symptoms on the weekends when MSNBC runs this endless sort of crime series. And I love, you know, and she's closer to anybody else to having, you know, and of course Bill Moyers is wonderful, but and occasionally Charlie Rose, but it's few and far between, and we really need more of the Bill Moyers kind of serious deep discussion of issues on more than just you know, he said, she said, finger pointing and soundbite arguments. Because we have, global warming, just to take one of our problems that we have now, I mean, global warming is just a huge problem. The problem of finding peace in the Middle East, however you feel about Afghanistan, the much bigger problem is peace in the Middle East, and it's tied to global hegemonies and power. And these are very, and that's tied to global warming. We really need to be talking, you know, with each other on a much deeper level.
Right.
So,
I just wanted to say thank you for your work. I first read A Course of Stones in grad school with actually several other people who are here tonight in one of our classes, and I was so excited about it, the way that you sort of zoom in and out and land on different topics and weave all these different narratives together and make these connections on a horizontal level that between the microcosm of the family and the larger social issues at work. And I thought that was really exciting because I'd never really seen that done before. And I thought it was like this moment of total simplicity where you're like, of course, why doesn't everybody think about it like this? And so I was really excited. And then I went to my mom and I said, Mom, you have to read this book. And she was like, I have that book. So she'd had it all along. I could have saved myself the $80,000 of grad school. But no, I'm just kidding. But my question to you was, Because it's such an ingenious idea, this this sort of zooming in and out that you do, and it sounds like you're doing in this book too, and making all these connections, and it sounds like that you came to that process through poetry. But I wondered if you could speak a little bit more about what your journey of writing was, and if you started with fiction and then found it in a way limiting, and then wanted to move beyond that, or how did you find this way of writing that you do, which is kind of a reportage or some documentarian.
This is a great question. I can tell you about that book specifically, and I will. But also, I'm realizing as you're speaking, because you're using this word zooming, which I love, that at a certain point I wanted to be a filmmaker. And I was studying the films of Pudovkin and Eisenstein, and who developed the whole idea of montage, and, you know, A plus B doesn't equal C, it equals a third thing. And that was very, very exciting to me. And so that I think has entered this whole process too, and you can see that I sort of construct these scenes almost, you know, images. I see them almost like scenes in films. The way that Chorus of Stones evolved, for instance, was that I did write fiction, and I have a novel that I'm writing now, which I love it, and I think I'm actually going to finally finish it. But the reason I shifted to nonfiction was, first place, I'm a very politically minded person, and in the early days of feminism, I had these issues. I had ideas about and wanted to write about, but also I needed to earn a living, and nonfiction was always, you know, it was always easier to earn a living that way. And partly, I suppose, that I put what I did into my nonfiction because I am a writer of literature, and I wanted to make that form hold all of me, you know. So I wanted it to hold the part of me that's interested in telling a story and making beautiful language too. So that was what was going on. But with A Chorus of Stones, I had two books in mind. I had a friend who's since died, and I dedicated the book partly to her. And her name was Alyssa Malamud, and she was a activist for disarmament, because we had this terrible arms race going on when I began the book between the Soviet Union and America at that point. She was the one who kind of educated me in how dangerous the situation was. I mean, we had these submarines going around that could fire off, get a nuclear weapon exploding over the Soviet Union within about, you know, 5 minutes or something. There's not enough time for anybody to blink, and suddenly the Earth is being destroyed, you know. That subject began to enter my dreams and my unconscious, and it was some sort of gripped me, and it was like I felt I couldn't write about anything else. It wasn't a moral duty type of thing. I mean, it's not that I don't believe in moral duties, but that's not what mainly motivates me. I don't know. I'm just a more hot-blooded person than that. So I was just motivated. I was gripped. I was just gripped by this subject. And then at the same time, I don't know if you remember this period, but it was when Alex Haley's Roots was made into a TV series, and was watching it avidly and very, very moved by it. And in that period, I realized, oh, my God, I had two grandmothers. Now, everybody has two grandmothers, but my father's mother had been erased, and I suddenly became incredibly, not only curious, but I just suddenly had to know more about her, and yet I didn't even have a name for her when I started out. And I thought I had these two books that I just had to write both of them, and what was I going to do? But the more that I, you know, sort of like, you know, positive and negative electrical energy or something, you know, the more I held them close together, there was this incredible force field between them. And so I didn't even know that they were connected by denial, believe it or not. But I just jumped into that space in between and found out.
We have time for one more question over here.
It's actually more of a comment than chiming in with a Chorus of Stones. I think of you so often because I see times when that personal family repressed something or other. Like mm-hmm. in one case, it was my artist friend had a teacher who came out as a lesbian really late in life after being married for 35 years or something, mm-hmm. and she felt like really strange, really weird. Like, why was this happening to her so late? She went to visit her own mother in a mental institution, and her mother, in some delusion, started talking about this girl that she had been involved with in high school or something like that, and she realized that her mother had repressed this thing, and then in her own life it had surfaced in the daughter so many years later and seemed like a revelation. And then I went to a writing colony, and I knew nothing about my own mother's background, and she spoke mostly Spanish. And I had a dream where she was painting, and so I wrote a poem called My Mother's Art. And my mother was painting pictures of Los Angeles, you know, like...
Yeah.
The now, you know, obliterated Ambassador Hotel and things like that. But it was very Southern California, and it was published in a book, and a friend of mine that lived near my mother translated it for her because my mother didn't read English. And she called me up and told me that did I know that when she was young, she wanted to be a painter. You know, and this
amazing.
Is a woman who always, like, you know, worked menial jobs, you know, cleaned toilets and that kind of thing.
Yes.
I had no notion.
Yeah.
And it's in that space of being... away in that quiet thing that you talked about, that this dream came up, and I couldn't possibly have known it. She never spoke about art. In fact, just sitting here when I thought about what I was going to say, I thought the only thing, art-related thing, that my mother and I shared was that in high school, she and I did a paint-by-numbers of Blue Boy, a big one.
Blue Boy, I love it.
Yeah, in Culver City, and Louise and I share that route.
Love it.
And that was the only thing, but, like, I couldn't have gotten anything from that.
Yeah.
And I just love that, and I bring that up in so many conversations, you know, about you and A Chorus of Stones and how resonant that is, how families and in nations and in the world, these things that are, you know, repressed or unspoken, you know, come up, and then I'm wanting to find a little hope in that. Like now when we find ourselves so oppressed by corporations, mm-hmm. whatever, the kind of human qualities that are being, you know, repressed, maybe we're silently passing them on to the next generation, and they will erupt, you know, and we'll have another revolution.
That's wonderful, and I really do feel that there's something in human nature that's very profound that doesn't, at a certain point, just... you know, doesn't go along with a program that's tempting to reduce and confine humanity. And so I'm so glad you said that.
Thank you. On that note of gratitude and insight, thank you so much for your work and for
you.
And this place welcomes you back.
Oh, it's so lovely to be here.
Thank you so much, Susan. And Susan's book is for sale in the lobby, and she'll be signing in just a few minutes. So thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.